Kia ora, I'm Lee from Wilderness and welcome to Track Chat. Today I'm chatting with Hazel Phillips, who is the author of 5 books of nonfiction, about her latest book, Great Hearts. Welcome, Hazel.
Hello.
What is Great Hearts about?
It is fundamentally a social history of women mountaineers, and it runs from 1873, when a woman first walked on the glaciers of Mount Cook, through to 1953, which was the year of the first all-woman unguided ascent of Araki Mount Cook. And it tells the individual stories of 30 woman climbers, while at the same time telling the wider narrative about how women's mountaineering developed and the kind of barriers that they had to overcome.
I loved this book. What drew you to researching and writing a history of women mountaineers? And also, why did these stories need to be told?
I started kind of cherry picking the research about 10 years ago, I think, when I discovered Frieda Dufour's book, The Conquest of Mount Cook. I read that, and she's the first woman who climbed Araki Mount Cook, and I was quite sort of taken with her book, but also just with this idea that there were all these women out there who'd done these amazing things that you otherwise would never hear of. So I've kind of spent about a decade researching women climbers, but also grappling with the archival absence. You know, they didn't often talk about themselves, and sort of thinking critically about how the stories that lie outside of any dominant narrative tend to get suppressed and sometimes dismissed and sometimes also erased. And the more that I dug into it, I was kind of astonished to find that these early women climbers were treated as footnotes almost. So mountaineering literature has often historically been, I guess, a tool of empire and ego, right? And often written by a specific class of men, and there's some privilege inherent in that too. And women's achievements, when they're only included kind of as footnotes, or let's have a chapter on a woman also climbed, I think standard historical tools start to fail us. It can be very hard to find information, especially from the woman themselves. And so eventually I realized that this project couldn't just be a compilation of facts, that it required some sort of approach or methodology that was going to challenge not just the authority of who gets to decide what constitutes history and who gets included, but the archive itself.
And in the book, you've used a technique that's called critical fabulation to fill in some of those archival gaps. Can you tell us about this technique?
Yeah, it's been really fun, actually. When I sat down, I thought that I wouldn't have that many women, that there just wouldn't be that many. And so I thought, if I get 20 women, that will be, you know, a real win. And in the end, I had 80 women, a long list of 80 women, and whittled it down to 30. And I started sort of writing up their stories, and they sounded like obituaries. It was pretty grim. And I didn't want to focus on just the climbing. I wanted to know who they were as people and to kind of reimagine what their lives might have been like. And so I've written their stories sort of mostly as nonfiction, but each of their stories includes a fiction scene from that woman's point of view. And that approach was really fun. So I've borrowed from Saidiya Hartman's concept of critical fabulation for that approach. And that's a method designed to confront the gaps and silences and omissions and erasures that you see in the archives. And a great example would be Anna von Lindenfeld, who was on the first ascent of Hochstetter Dome in 1883. Now, not the first woman's ascent, but the first ascent, you know, with her husband and a porter. She left no account in her own words. We have absolutely nothing from her point of view with Anna speaking. So everything we know about that ascent was written by her husband, Robert. He got the voice and he got the authority to speak about it, and she didn't. And so when the archive is empty like that, as a traditional historian, I think you would stop because it's just not there in a nonfiction sense. But if you take an approach of creative scholarship, you can sort of fill in the blanks and reimagine their lives and bring history to life in new ways. And that's not necessarily, it's not a kind of a license to just sort of make up whatever you want. I think the fiction has to stay really anchored to the historical record as much as it might test the boundaries. So it's about reconstructing those women's interiority and their feelings and hopes and dreams that they might have been denied, and filling the silences, giving them back a voice and telling their stories. And I really think that using a first-person point of view in particular is a way of reclaiming lost power. So the fiction scenes, they talk as themselves, not being talked about.
And of the 30, do you have any favourites?
I do. I've got quite a few, as you can imagine. First of all, Freda Dufour haunted me in my dreams. She appeared to me and told me that her chapter had to be different. And so she dictated it to me. And then I didn't do anything about it. And then she reappeared to me in my dreams and told me off. So that was quite a unique kind of experience. I'm sure that was just my subconscious talking to me creatively. But I preferred the idea that I've been haunted by a historic lady climber. So although I don't particularly like Freda as a person, I found her quite arrogant. But I loved Betsy Blunden. She blagged her way into a guiding job at the Hermitage in the 1920s. And in the interview, she was asked, have you climbed mountains before? And she said yes, but she just neglected to mention that they were the sort of mountains you could actually reach on horseback quite easily. And she moved very quickly from being a picnic guide to guiding on bigger climbs. And the way she did that was waiting until all the male guides were booked up. And then she would suggest high climbs to the guests at the Hermitage, because she knew she'd be the only person available for the job. So I think she had a lot of hustle and self-belief. And one of my other favourites is Ida Corrie, who saved her own guide, Mark Lysons, in 1933. They were on the first ascent of Mount Goldsmith, and on the way down, he jumped a shrund and he broke his leg, and Ida took control of the situation and she cut steps and belayed him to safety. And she was really applauded in the mountaineering world for that, even internationally, because you know, 1933 women were not expected to be able to even lead a climb, let alone save a guide. So that was pretty awesome. And then there were the sisters Maud and Alfie Williams, who were rich, privileged society girls, as many of the early woman climbers were. They holidayed at the Hermitage in the late 1880s. And Maud became a fairly well-known artist eventually. They did a lot of smaller summits like Wakefield and Sebastopol completely on their own, presumably so that Maud could sketch and paint. And it was pretty unusual at that time for young women to be kicking around unchaperoned, let alone climbing anything at all without a guide. So I'd love to get in the time machine and go back and go on a climb with them.
What kind of obstacles did they need to overcome in order to climb at all?
Yeah, society's expectations would be the start and probably the biggest one. It was considered pretty unnatural to climb. I think even for men, some men were considered a bit mad for climbing way back. And New Zealand has this really strong history of eugenics, which is the idea that we can achieve a more pure race through who is and isn't allowed to breed, right? Pretty awful. So young women were always encouraged towards these more delicate pursuits with the aim of getting married and producing healthy babies for the good of the nation. And independence wasn't encouraged, of course, and outdoor activity beyond croquet and perhaps gentle walks was just not the done thing. And if you go back and look at some of the commentary from Plunkett Society founder Treby King, he believed that the body was a closed system and had a finite store of energy. So women who expended their energy on adventurous pastimes like climbing would have nothing left for the essential tasks of bearing and raising children. And then climbing was considered deeply unfeminine. So Freda Dufour in particular, she wrote about how she enjoyed stepping out in her prettiest frock to counteract perceptions that a woman mountaineer was, and I think I quote here, a masculine looking female with short hair, a loud voice and large feet. And then, of course, women were also often directly discriminated against. So, for example, the Canterbury Mountaineering Club, although it's come a very long way now, it was formed in 1927 but didn't allow women members until 1977. So that's a lot of training and knowledge and gear that Canterbury and Christchurch women didn't necessarily get access to, and they ended up forming their own teams and even making their own gear, which you can read about in the book. And the clothing and the gear, of course, is a barrier too.
And when we consider the clothing and the gear, do you find it incredible that they achieved what they did?
Yeah, absolutely. Freda was criticised for wearing a skirt, but if she didn't wear a skirt, that was also a problem. So it was sort of deemed unsafe if you had a long skirt because you could catch it or it could blow up completely over your head or something like that. But, you know, if you didn't have a skirt, that you were dressing like a man, and that was also not acceptable. But the really early women, like the late 1800s, the women going onto the glaciers, they climbed or stepped out in their Sunday best. So if you think about those long dresses, wide-brimmed hats that were sort of draped with a motoring veil and the fancy gloves, so it was almost like church in the morning and glaciers by noon sort of thing. And they carried alpenstocks, which is a kind of like an iron-tipped walking stick. And the guides would cut steps into ice faces and they would climb in that way. And then that changed by the early 1900s. So they got into hobnailed boots and long ice axes, proper ice axes. And then again, by about the 1930s, crampons became much more widespread. By 1953, when you see the photos of the woman on the first unguided all-woman climb of Aoraki, they were wearing trousers and flannel shirts, and they've got the rope and everything. And so they're out there and with their really modern tools.
Well, what do you think we can learn from these stories today?
I think that women could take comfort that there's a path already been carved out for them by these very tough and tenacious women, that all of this has already gone before. And, you know, we do still see little bits of discrimination here and there. And I think reading back through their stories and realizing the things that they've overcome and faced, that's really heartening.
Thank you so much, Hazel, for having a chat today, and all the best for the book.
Thanks, Lee.